and you just computed the hypotenuses all day, every day. It's been a whirlwind of a week, man. You and I have both fallen into a deep, deep obsession with this one subject of long-termism. And I am so looking forward to talking about this because I've been pretty much thinking of nothing else but this subject for the last like 5 or 6 days. And there's so for the audience, there will be some writing coming out from both of us, I think, on this one. And we have a lot to say on it. So I don't know, man, like, what are your thoughts?
Yeah. I've lost many work hours thinking about this over the past like 72 hours. For me, it's like been a fascinating space because I've considered myself a part of the EA community for like a number of years, maybe. And even as, you know, late as like a few months ago, I would have said I'm somewhat sympathetic. I would have said, I guess I'm sympathetic to long-termism as a moral philosophy. And I think that came out in like our second or third conversation or something where we started butting heads even then a bit about it. Yeah. And then you turned me on to some other thinkers and just some other way of reasoning. And in that time, I've like pivoted basically 180 degrees to thinking this is actually an incredibly dangerous idea that people are developing. And it's an idea that just like inoculates itself for various reasons that we'll get into.
Yeah.
From criticism, and inoculates itself from criticism and also inoculates us, if taken seriously, from making actual progress. I've actually become very worried about it for reasons that we'll get into. Yeah, it's a weird place for me to stand, I think, because I do have a lot of sympathy with the EA community and its goals. You know, I think it's accomplished a lot of good over the course of its short career and has generated some of like the most important moral ideas that we have right now. So, you know, like donating based on impact rather than just like the emotional valence of a charity is, I think, a fantastic way to start viewing philanthropy. And also just considering that like altruism and philanthropy is a hard problem, a problem that needs to be solved. It's a resource allocation problem, right? Like we have finite resources and we have to dedicate them in a way that solves as many problems and alleviates as much suffering as possible. So I think taking like a problem solving mentality to altruism is also just like been a fantastic idea. And then just advocating ethics on an ethics that's grounded in impartiality is, I think, possibly one of the best ethical ideas that's come out of a society ever, and has allowed us to like broaden the scope of our moral circle to people living in distant countries and to animals. And so looking back at all this, you know, it's been like a huge force for good in my life and has like changed many of my behaviors, has made my life more fulfilling and stuff. And so I'm coming at this conversation from a point of like concern for a friend that's like sort of fallen ill. So I view the community as like having 90 to 95% excellent ideas. And it's full of a bunch of people who have very good motivations, I think. But then this is one idea that's popped up that I think has the potential to do a massive amount of harm. And also to eradicate a lot of the progress that's been made by the movement, and to just like deviate them so fully from their original goal, which was to be objective and data driven in their approach. And so, yeah, I've become very, very concerned about what I see here.
So I guess I'm cognizant of the fact that we have two distinct audiences. We have an audience of people who are in the community and will know what this long-termism thing is. And I think we'll have heard nothing but praise for the idea. That may be a bit strong because I would say I'm only really in the community through you. But there's that group of people. And then there's another group of people who have no idea what the hell we're talking about. No idea what long-termism is. No idea why we both have been obsessing about it. No idea why we're both like very worried about it. Like, I think the last time I was as worried about an idea, it is with the historicism one. And that was studying like an old idea. But this is, I think, kind of dangerous. And so before we dive in to the nitty gritty details, which will be coming in, both audio and written and all sorts of different forms, we should, address the people who aren't in the community and don't know what we're talking about, I think.
Yeah, I think it's worth it to also probably just step back and like recall what the EA community is. I feel like we use the term EA a lot. So EA, the context stands for effective altruism. And this is a movement that's been around, I don't know, since the mid-2000s or something. It's got sort of various different origins, depending on who you talk to. But the general idea is to use evidence and careful reasoning to tackle the problem of altruism. And so, like I was saying earlier, it's, you know, this is a problem to be solved. And the truth of how to do the most good as possible is a difficult truth to ascertain. So the community has just been built up of people who are sort of obsessed about this question, right? Like whether it's in the donation space to do with global poverty or the animal welfare space, the question is like, how do we allocate our time and resources to do as much good as possible?
And so William McCaskill is he the founder or is he just the most prominent spokesperson?
He would at least be the co-founder, I would say.
Okay, I heard about him a while ago, and he was so impressive because he gave the Play Pump story, which I know will be familiar to half of the audience, but maybe not to the other half. And so I'll just recount it here, where I'll probably get some of the details wrong, but correct me. But there was this idea of putting a merry-go-round in impoverished villages in developing countries. I think it was Africa. And the merry-go-round would also be attached to a water pump. Is that correct?
Yeah.
And the idea was that you could basically get two for one, where so the kids would have this like amazing experience spinning the pump round and round and enjoying themselves. And then the town would get clean water, or perhaps was it electricity? There was some extra benefit.
Water, I believe. Yeah. Water from a well.
Play pump, exactly. And so this garnered a huge amount of donations, and everyone was like really excited about this idea because everyone thought they were doing a lot of good in the world, right? Mm-hmm. But the problem with the play pump is that there was no data. They had stopped basically looking at the data, and or they didn't even ask to look at the data. It was just this belief that what was what they were doing was good for the world. But it turns out that the play pump was absolutely terrible. It was terrible because the kids would get tired and wouldn't enjoy spinning it around. And so they'd have to get like elderly women to move the stupid thing. And I guess it was just way less efficient than just bringing in like actual sanitation, water treatment, plants and stuff. And so the lesson, was that we can't just, assume that what we like think we're doing that's making the world better is actually making the world better. We need to look at the data. We need to look at the science. We need to constantly be like asking ourselves, like, can we be wrong? Or might we be wrong? And is our altruism effective? And so William McCaskill kind of brought this to people's attention. And then I believe he also started this amazing Giving What You Can pledge. Is that correct?
So that was started by him and Toby Ord, actually, just thought that they could publicize the idea of giving 10% of your income to the most effective charities, and that most people could do this without sacrificing anything major in their life. And therefore, this is like worthy of doing. So, yeah, they started this Giving What We Can organization. And the prominent feature of that is the Giving What We Can pledge.
And it was like so amazing. People were donating way more money than they would have. And not only were they donating it to charity organizations, but they were donating it to charity organizations that were committed to looking at the data and constantly checking to make sure that what they were doing was effective. Hence the name Effective Altruism. With this new idea of long-termism, the entire concept of looking at the data is gone. That is out the window. But they've kept the quantitative method. And so what the hell does that mean? That means they keep all the math, but they lose all of the parts that attach the math to reality. And what you and I are basically noticing is that it's essentially just like mathematical, I'm going to say masturbation because it's euphonic. It's just mathematical masturbation. Like the primary thing that caused the effective altruism movement to be so effective is that they looked at the data. With this long-termist movement, They're no longer doing that. But how is that possible? It's possible because they are obsessing about this thing called Bayesian epistemology, which is a term that works in some circles and doesn't in other circles. But like even right now, what I'm saying and what we're about to say is not going to be received positively by people within the community. But they're just playing games with probability and have lost touch with the thing which was so attractive about them in the first place. And so we have to go into long-termism and how this actually manifests itself. But this is the thing I think both you and I are noticing. And it is quite, I think, worrying because of the amount of potential they have. And so we're hoping that this is a slight redirection of like 10 degrees exactly. north and everything will get corrected again. But if we don't do this redirection, then I think it could start to metastasize into something that's quite dangerous. And so we have to go into the details, of course, and we will. But I hope that kind of set up the conversation both to those who are in and outside of the community.
Yeah, the final preliminary note I'll offer is that any scorn that we both have throughout this conversation and any expletives, I think it's safe to say they're directed towards the ideas, not towards the people. So, you know, the community of people is a group that I just like admire tremendously. And, you know, all these people are dedicating many more hours of their life to trying to do as much good as possible than I am in my day. And so I have the utmost respect for them. But ideas are not something that deserve our respect. Ideas are something that deserve to be, you know, we should criticize the hell out of. And so that's what we're doing here. We're going to take the beat down to long-termism. So I just want to emphasize that any sort of scorn that you hear from us is directly at the idea, not at the people. One thing I wanted to pick up on was the sort of this point you made about mathematical masturbation or like just appealing to mathematical authority. So one thing I realized while sort of prepping for the episode was that the community in general has done a fantastic job of throwing out appeals to authority when it comes to altruism. So typically, I would say altruism is dominated by sort of two forms of authority, one being emotional and one being religious. So by emotional authority, I mean people typically donate with their gut, right? Whatever makes them feel good, like, oh, you know, I've seen this person suffering or this organization is close to my heart, so I'm going to donate my dollars here. And then obviously religious communities have a lot to do with donation. I think EA has done a good job of like stepping away both from those types of authority and trying to get to the bottom of the question of like, how do we actually do the most good? But in the process, it seems to have picked up another dogma, another form of authority, and that's mathematical authority. And it just seems to me like it's just built its own prison here. Like it just, the forum these days and like the rationality community, which is like sort of associated with EA, it's just every post is about some sort of like mathematical issue that arises when you're trying to apply expected value calculations to the far future. And it's like people are unable to step away from this tool. And they can't remember that it's just a tool, right? It's just like expected value calculations and Bayes theorem are just tools that we use in some scenarios to help us reason through things. They are not the foundation of our knowledge and they do not deserve to be applied in every scenario. But it's just like people are so captivated by writing integrals and summations over possible future states that like, we've just confused ourselves into literally building our own prison brick by brick. And now we just can't get out of it. You know, now we're just like, we consider that there's a Graham's number of people to come in the future and it paralyzes every form of argument. And it's just like, you can't get around it. So it's just like, I'm trying to argue against this like mathematical puritanism that has just come to dominate the entire debate. It's just like tremendously scary because I think the move being made in the paper is not like, you know, we are an elite who understands math and you are not. Like, they lay out the mathematical claims in the paper in a way that if you have a well-versed enough background, you can dive into. But the main type of authority I'm actually worried about here is the authority that these symbols on paper command. So if you have enough of a background to understand math, then, you know, then they can point at an equation and say, like, you know, stop questioning the math itself. Look, like, the expected number of people in the future is a bajillion, quadrillion, bajillion. And how dare you question the probability calculus, right? So it's not just an appeal to people making arguments that they claim you can't understand. It's like this pernicious claim to just that symbols capture something about reality that we cannot capture with any other form of explanation. And so it's this claim that like mathematics is not simply just represent, it's not a tool that's used to represent reality sometimes when it's useful. It's that it represents something truer than you can even understand, and you're not allowed to question it.
So, okay. So, which paper are we talking about? And, let's
dive into it. Yeah. So,
yeah.
We're talking about, the case for strong long-termism. This is on the Global Priorities Institute's website. It's by Hilary Gries and Will McCaskill. And it's a working paper, but I think the first draft was published in September 2019 or so. And to just get into it, so I think the following quote gives people an idea of what's at stake here. So the fourth paragraph of the paper, the end of it reads as follows. The idea then is that for the purposes of evaluating actions, we can, in the first instance, often simply ignore all the effects contained in the first 100 or even 1,000 years, focusing primarily on the further future effects. Short-run effects act as little more than tiebreakers. So what they're saying here is, if their argument is correct, near-term effects, short-term effects do not matter. There's so much moral value captured by all the people in the future that action, suffering, and problems now are little more than rounding errors when it comes to the total amount of well-being in the universe. And so I say this. So one, that quote was read directly from the paper, and I don't want to try and score points by just reading things in derogatory tone. So I don't take that quote to be any sort of argument, but I do want people to understand that the stake of this argument is very high. So if this view was widely adopted by just the general public, we might just stop caring about, for example, helping people in poverty or abolishing factory farming or ending injustice that's rampant in the world, right? So those would just stop being our moral priorities. And so
it would be viewed as a rounding error, negligible in the grand scheme of things, utterly to be discarded as a triviality. In the same way that you ignore the sixth decimal place of a calculation, you ignore the suffering and starvation of people in Africa. It doesn't matter. And so I'm writing a piece on this, and it's currently undergoing many revisions. And in the first draft, the tone was quite, let's euphemize it and say sharp. And so what I said was that this, would, let's say the full implications of the view aren't, either endorsed or, really explored, by the piece. And so the authors at the end of the day, the decisions that they're going to advocate are mainly about choosing between different charities. But again, if you, like you said, if taken seriously, this would allow pedophiles and rapists and murderers to justify their actions by belief that it doesn't matter how they treat people right now, right here, because they're donating to AI safety. And as long as you prevent AI from taking over the world, then you can pretty much do anything you want. It doesn't matter because in expected value calculations, when you calculate the expectation of future well-being between now and 1 quadrillion years from now, I think is the number they use, or 1 billion years, then it all washes out. The rape and torture of a child is just a rounding error. It really doesn't matter. Again, at no point do the authors ever say this, but this is what a world would look like if these ideas are widely believed by everyone. We have to, I think, keep that in mind when we go into these very academic illustrations of how they've arrived at this conclusion. Because, of course, like Hilary Gries and William McCaskill, they're considerate, kind people who are trying to make the world better. And I think they've just been hypnotized by their own mathematics in such a way that they are not fully appreciating the consequences of what they are espousing. Right. And so I just want to echo in my own way that the stakes are really, really high here.
Yeah, I want to emphasize one more time that we're not making an argument by moral indignation here. So I can hear people who are sympathetic to the long-termist thesis screaming, all you're doing is using incredibly harsh language to discredit the argument. And so I'm not saying, we have not made an argument against long-termism yet. I need to be very clear about that. All we're saying is that the stakes are very high. So that's what's on the line, right? If you adopt long-termism, then we're throwing out how much near-term consequences like really matter in the big scheme of things. I mean, because I can just hear the rebuttal, right? Like, you know, people 1,000 years ago are sitting around saying, this new utilitarian philosophy demands that we take women's rights seriously. That's so absurd, right? So the argument to like, or the argument by moral intuition is often a bad one, and one I'm very skeptical of. And one, indeed, that the EA community has been right to be skeptical of, interestingly enough.
So you're right that we should be skeptical of moral intuitions, but I have now seen this counter argument that I'm calling the conflicts with moral intuitions rebuttal, because I hear this so many fucking times that you'll say something crazy and then I'll say, that sounds a little crazy. And then you say, well, that just conflicts with your moral intuitions.
Right.
And really, like, don't you know that we used to think that violence was okay and that was a moral intuition? And so the crazy thing that I just said, that conflicts with your moral intuition too. And so really you should just like, take a step back and, check your privilege, to use jargon from a different bubble. But all these bubbles have the same kind of tools. So the conflicts with moral intuition thing has a counter concern, which is that it can be used to squash legitimate feelings of unease, that what you're being told makes absolutely no fucking sense whatsoever.
Yeah, that's a good point.
This is a appeal to authority in this way that is like very duplicitous. And so I just want to bring that up because that I've seen this move made enough times on enough different forums and by enough different people that the conflicts with your moral intuitions bit is often a way to just get people to shut the hell up when the inside of their voice is their inner voice is saying, this doesn't make any sense.
Yeah, that's a good point. So it's not, it can't be used as an argument for, and it can't be used as an argument against. Otherwise you're just committing the anti-naturalistic fallacy, like the converse of the naturalistic fallacy. So it's not a point for and against. Yeah. And I mean, indeed you should take some conflict with your emotional intuition somewhat seriously, because our intuitions can change over time with the right arguments. And so if you can't get the current argument to get on board with your intuitions at all, that could be a cue that, of course, can be overturned by yet a better explanation. But that should be something that flags, or that, you know, stops your code running at that point and makes you curious as to what's happening.
So there's Popper doesn't use the phrase moral intuition, but he does talk about common sense a lot. Hmm. And he says that common sense is often the starting place for inquiry, but it is itself common sense to know that common sense is often wrong. And so it is a good place to start. And if something conflicts with common sense, that doesn't necessarily mean we should discard it, but it does mean that that we should keep it. It just means that we should interrogate it a bit further. And
yeah, exactly.
The one other piece I want to add to that is that, like, we all have this little interior light that shines when something makes sense. when I say something, or when you say something, and we receive one another's statement, it just like makes pieces click into place. Everyone can feel that. It just works. And that tiny little light can be extinguished so fucking fast when people are bludgeoned like endlessly that they should never trust their moral intuitions or common sense, and they just get used to this like feeling of paralysis, this feeling that like probability doesn't make sense and everything I've been told doesn't totally click in, but everybody else around me is talking as if it does, and I it's got to be that I'm wrong and this is just how it is. And so just if anyone feels this way about expected value calculus and like it's never really clicked into place, but everyone else just talks about it so much that you feel like there's something wrong with you, it's not. and so this moral intuition, this common sense, this idea that like things make sense in the world, is very important to nurture and to trust in yourself as well. And so I just wanted to add that because we're so used to being told endlessly by the EA folks that this conflicts with our moral intuitions. We can't trust it. And then I think we just get inured to the feeling of things ever making sense at all. So.
Right, you just wanted to talk about the little light inside you there. Hey?
This little light of mine.
Yeah. Touch your little light with my little light. One thing I also want to say is like this happens in academia a lot is like someone kind of has an idea and doesn't formalize it. And then another person comes along and makes a little bit of a change and perhaps gives it a name and whatnot. So I'm not sure like who exactly came up with this idea, but we should credit at least Nick Beckstead, who had a thesis on this. And I think this is maybe the earliest formal work on long-termism. I do admire people dedicating a PhD to problems they think are important. And then I just think it's the role for the rest of us to, you know, criticize the hell out of it. But people need to generate ideas, and that's good. So yeah, shout out to his thesis. But I realized we never said exactly what the main thesis of long-termism is, and so we should probably do that. So the general idea here is that humans have not been around very long. Like if you look at the typical length for a mammalian species, humans evolved relatively recently. And so we should expect that humans, our species continues long into the future. Even if you just use the underlying base rates for like mammals. And then you take into account that humans have this unique creativity, and are able to adapt and construct technology that allows them to thrive in environments and new environments. And so then maybe your expectation for how long humans will be around is, you know, maybe 200,000 more years, a million more years, whatever, depending on how creative we are. And so therefore, because we're so infant in our lifespan as a species, most of the people who are yet to live actually come in the future. So if I think it's written somewhere, you know, I think Toby Ord uses this in his book, The Precipice, like if the human story were a book, we'd be on the very first page. And so there are so many millions and billions and trillions of people to come after us that if you value people equally, independent of the time in which they live, then most of our moral value actually just lies in the future, as opposed with the present generation. And so if we are truly good, impartial, axiological utilitarians, then we should be mostly concerned with these people in the future, right? So if there is a choice between helping people now and helping the billions of people in the future, then we should help the people in the future. So that's why the consequences for helping people now wash out. And then when Vaden starts talking about the expected value calculus, how that gets imported into this discussion is via the number of people we expect to live in the future. So you start taking the probability of us colonizing the stars and being able to live until the heat death of the universe, or maybe there's the probability of us just lasting as long as a typical mammalian species. So for each of these possibilities, you generate some ad hoc number of humans. This is where my tone's going to get a little more skeptical for how many people could, you know, will live in each of these scenarios. And you sort of take an average over this and you say, well, you know, in some of these scenarios, there could be 10 to the 50 more humans that come about, or sentient beings, not necessarily just humans. And some of them only a couple trillion. And so, you know, even on the most conservative of these estimates, our expected value calculus gives us that there will be so many people in the future that it's worth mostly paying attention to them as opposed to the people now.
And it's the expected value calculus applied to different actions you can mm-hmm. take, right? So the idea is that if I drink a glass of water, that is going to have like a ripple effect into the future and change the probabilities and the various alternatives. And if I instead of drinking a glass of water, I donate money to a charitable organization, that'll have a different ripple effect mm-hmm. into the future. And we can somehow foresee this ripple effect into infinity well enough to summarize it with a single number. And then we're going to take this number and we're going to use that to make a decision based and say, okay, well, I shouldn't drink water. I should instead donate to charity. And so the expected value calculus is a way to adjudicate between different decisions from its proponents. So that's all I want to say, which is that like the probabilities and stuff are associated with one of many different choices. And then the choice you choose is the one that is going to maximize the expected value.
And so now I think maybe we should just start getting into like what the premises are, whether they hold water, and then what the alternatives are. Like, you know, we keep criticizing the hell out of this, but like, what else can we do? Because my sense is that a lot of people in the community say, yeah, these numbers are super, they're pretty unreliable, right? Like, we definitely can't know for certain that in world A, there's going to be 10 to the 15 plus 3 people. And in world B, there's going to be 10 to the 17 people. But we have to try to solve this problem because it's so, because there could be so many people in the future that even if we're wrong, the expected impact we'll have here. Notice that you can just keep recursively appealing to the expected value calculus. The expected impact of anything we can do on this front is so important. We can't ignore it, right? This is the problem we must solve. I know it's uncertain. I know it's hard, but by God, those 10 to the 17 people need us, you know, and so we got to focus on them.
It's like Popper. Also, in one of our conversations, I kept using the phrase like it's impossible, but we have to do it anyways. It's so important. We have to do the impossible, and something's got to give. And what's not going to give is the impossible.
It's impossible.
I promise you that. Yeah. But Popper talked about this too, because he noticed that this was the same injunction that was used to recruit people into communism. So the revolution is coming. Listen, I know it's hard. I know your moral intuitions think it's not going to be coming, but it's coming, and I need you to join the revolution and come help to bring about the inevitable. You see a similar kind of paradox there, right? Which is, come help us do something which is going to be done whether or not you're helping. And so you basically have no choice. The choice is made for you. You're either joining the revolution, you're helping to bring it about, or you're getting in its way and making the world worse. The exact same logic is applied here with different words. So the consequence of not donating to AI safety, which is the continual, let's say, gravitational mass that all of these arguments keeps getting steered towards.
Black hole of long-termism.
Everything always steers towards AI safety. So just know that there's this like planetary system and that all arguments kind of just get pulled over in that direction always and forever in this space, but we'll ignore that temporarily. But the point is either you sit at your desk and do nothing and you're basically complicit with the death of an infinite number of people in expectation, obviously, because no one could know this but there's so much uncertainty, but in expectation, you'd be complicit. Or if you make the right action, then you will no longer be complicit. You'll help to prevent the inevitable. And so it's the same move, different language, but it's this like, it's so important that you got to come help and you can't think for yourself. Stop thinking for yourself. Here, let me give you the tool to think. I will give you the way that you should be thinking about this problem.
Right, yeah, exactly.
Either through the doctrine of Marxism or through this mathematical tool called expected value calculus. You can totally think for yourself using the tool that I give you. And that's how this thing works.
Notice how easy this justification is to change on the fly, right? So if someone says, oh, I'm really unsure about like working on AI safety, I could either like go work at the AMF or I could go do AI safety work. And, you know, I don't think maybe AI safety work has like a 0.00001 chance of influencing the far future. Well, then someone can say, well, let me tell you how many people will live in the future. It's going to be at least 100 quadrillion times that. So in expectation, you are, in fact, saving millions of lives.
And then they say, no, but hold on. But Ben, that seems even less believable. My credence for that has now gone from 10 to the negative 10 to 10 to the negative 11. You're like, ah, but it just so happens.
I have good news.
I have good news for you, sir. That doesn't matter. That doesn't matter because in expectation, You still have to come help.
It's not funny, but it is funny. Sometimes I still can't help laughing at it. I don't know if it's because I'm laughing at the horror of it or if I just honestly find it funny. But so I think, you know, people are probably, especially that are very sympathetic to this thesis, are like so close to being fed up with us right now because we're just making fun of cherished beliefs and we're not offering any alternatives. So let me offer some alternatives. So for the Pascal's mugging case, I'm going to write a separate piece about it. It deserves like a slightly longer treatment, but I don't want to hide the explanation of like why it's not a paradox. And the reason is this, it's because the mugger is giving you a bad explanation as to, in the thought experiment, she either purports to have magical powers or be able to torture an absurd number of people simultaneously, depending on which version of the thought experiment you're engaging with. And this is just a bad explanation. And we throw out bad explanations for phenomenon all the time. That's how, and we don't assign tiny credences to them. We don't assign tiny credences to every plausible theory, every plausible world. We don't do this in science because it's not the way to get to the truth. If there's a better explanation for a theory, we abide by that explanation. And then we work with that until we falsify that one and we have a better explanation. But we don't just assign credences to every possible explanation.
You don't average out relativity and string theory and quantum mechanics in order to get the new theory.
Exactly. So, you know, we had Newtonian mechanics and we have Einsteinian relativity, and both of these at some point are competing explanations. And so we run experiments and we decide, oh, there's experimental evidence that Newtonian mechanics does not account for. And so we throw it out as the worst explanation. We don't still hold it with a credence of 0.25. It's just not the way to get to knowledge. And then when at some points there's two competing explanations, right? So right now for the theory of everything, quote unquote, we have quantum mechanics and we have general relativity, sort of the two pillars of modern physics. But it makes no sense to assign these both probabilities that sum to one. Right now, what you do is try and criticize the hell out of both of them until one of them falls short or until you come up with a better explanation that can account for everything seen. And so anyway, this deserves like some more treatment, but you know, the mugger claiming that she can hurt billions of people at once or that she has access to magical dimensions is just a bad explanation. And so we don't abide by it and you don't give her your wallet. So that's the answer.
We talk about Einstein and Darwin, but just it's important to remind people that this applies to everything you do in your life. If you have to go to the supermarket and someone gives you the address, but the directions they gave don't really make a lot of sense because you know that it's not where they say it is, then that's a bad explanation. And then you ask questions and then you ask a question and that is criticism. It's interrogating the idea. It is not an appeal to authority. It is a recognition that every human being is capable of understanding the world and making sense and producing ideas that can benefit it. And when something doesn't make sense to somebody, they receive and should ask for and should not settle for anything less than a good explanation. And the insistence that all explanations must come in one and only one form, and the form is expected value calculus, is so limited. Let me just say limited.
Yeah.
It should appear troubling to one if one can't let go of something, I think. And the expected value calculus, I'm surprised to find that this is that. It would be like someone not being able to let go of the Pythagorean theorem. Like, just like ask yourself how ridiculous it would be if you made moral decisions based on the Pythagorean theorem. if you just computed hypotenuses all day long and then used it to solve questions of like, should you go to university? Should you go traveling? And you just computed the hypotenuses all day, every day. This is lunacy. This is absolute lunacy. This is not helping you solve any questions of substance. And expected value calculus is the same fucking thing. You're just doing math. And that is great. And math is a tool, like you've said, but it is not an oracle. and once you make the shift in perspective, and you realize that this whole ocean of paradoxes that they're just swimming in can all go away instantaneously. Like, you just have to laugh, except that you cry because
except that there's millions of dollars being
yeah. So excellent. And we should say, like, this is David Deutsch and Karl Popper and David Miller, and so there is a tradition of this. This is not is widely known, and that's part of the reason why we are doing this podcast. Basically,
yeah. I mean, but one thing to emphasize is like, yes, like Deutsch and Popper, they put their finger on this. It's like, hey, this is how we proceed. But people, as you say, people do this in day-to-day life. This is how we know how to reliably generate knowledge, right? What we don't do is assign the credence that someone was lying about the supermarket address, and then also that the supermarket possibly changed addresses in the last day or the last year, or that it's changed, been painted or something.
Or that we're living in a simulation too.
Or, yeah, exactly.
Again,
yeah.
The simulation argument falls out immediately. It's just a bad explanation. It can explain everything. All of these paradoxes, which Bostrom and Yukowski just churn out like minute by minute, most of them just immediately fall by the wayside because they just make up fantasy worlds that don't explain anything. It explains everything, and that's why it's a bad explanation.
This is what I mean by being hoodwinked by the math, right? Like, if you only abide by math, yes, these actually become real problems that you have to sit down and scratch your head over and write papers about. But if you, like, step outside your mathematical toolkit and ask, like, wait, how do we generate knowledge normally? Like, what's our most reliable way to generate knowledge? It doesn't have to be in mathematical form, right? We just, like, seek better and better reasons for believing things.
In the piece that I talk about David Foster Wallace at this point because his brilliant Kenyon College commencement address, it's titled "This Is Water," and he describes this little parable of, like, I'm sure most people will be familiar, but just for those who aren't, two fish like swimming down the ocean stream, and then the big older fish is swimming back at them. And the older fish says, "Morning, boys, how's the water?" The fish swim on a little longer. One turns to the other and says, "What the hell is water?" And the water here is the framework. It's the network of assumptions and beliefs that you hold that you're constantly swimming in that is really hard to notice when it's everywhere all around you at once. That's why the water example is a useful one. But once someone points it out, then you can't not see it. It pops out like a 3D image. And it's so striking once you recognize this to see an entire community of people all just drowning when all they need to do is, like, move to the land. It is so perplexing because all of the criticism which they anticipate is all still within the same framework, which is quite surprising because Hilary Graves has co-published with David Wallace. She has written extensively on David Deutsch. Like, she knows these people. And yet just a complete refusal to try something new, to consider a different approach, to consider the Popperian Deutschian worldview, or even just not even, you don't have to go that far. Just try something that's not expected value calculus. Just try that and see where that gets you. See how reasoning goes. Because as you said, it is so intuitive. It's innate within all of us. The thing that makes Popper and Deutsch, like, stand out is that they just describe what we do all the time. It isn't a weird theory that we have to conform to. It is a description of what we are already doing. And once you just recognize that human beings have this ability to produce new knowledge and that this is just simply description of that, then you can identify when people are deviating away from that course or if they are hewing to it and undergoing all the struggles which come from trying to produce new knowledge. And it's hard. Criticism is a pain in the ass. It sucks. Like, it's not fun to be criticized. You write something, you're proud of it, and then people criticize it. It sucks.
I get criticized on this show every fucking time. I always end up changing my mind. It's the worst. Every week is like another fucking existential catastrophe for me. Yeah. God damn it.
But like, once you take it on and you just realize that this is the process, and then you seek it out and it becomes like who you are, and what you require from your friends and your partner and from everyone. Criticism and the desire to improve one another mutually forever. Then you just see a bunch of people standing around in a circle shooting themselves in the foot forever, and you're trying to help, but they just start shooting at you. So
I don't want to leave, you know, I don't want to end part one without at least saying what at least my thoughts are on long-termism and like what the other framework is. And the other framework is, put simply, it's don't try and measure that which is immeasurable. So right now there is this tendency, as you said, to say, but there could be so many future people. We have to try. No, you don't. You don't have to try. And indeed, the way we don't accept this kind of reasoning in any other aspect of life, in any other scientific endeavor, right? We don't try and predict things thousands of years out because we know we don't have the knowledge to do that. And so the best thing we can do is work with the present and try and make the future better that way. So one thing I want to emphasize here is if you throw out long-termism as a philosophy, you don't actually have to throw out the care for future generations. So there is a place that's to stand really where you say, we are concerned about people in the future and we do give them moral weight. So if you know Bob is going to exist in the future, you don't have to discount his suffering. But having concern for is different than prioritizing. It's different than saying we have to work on that because it's so important. Because the answer is working on that cannot possibly be effective because we don't know anything about the future. We don't know what problem situations is going to be facing. We don't know what society is going to look like. How we generate knowledge is to incrementally work with the problems we have now, solve those problems. Those problems generate new problems, and we work to solve those. Trying to predict things out 1,000 years hence destroys this means of how we've actually gotten anywhere. So, you know, how we've gotten. And so what's so bizarre is they recognize this in the piece, right? So section 3.1 points out like life has gotten so much better. And I think they even use the word incrementalism. I think they even, you know, they say every generation, we've improved a little bit. We've improved a little bit. Why has every generation been able to do that? Because they solve the problems at the time, because those are the only problems they know how to solve. If we had stopped trying to make progress right after the Enlightenment and said, let's try and predict what the year 2500 is going to look like, we would have just stood at a standstill. And then to say, well, so one move that I see made a lot is, well, here's how we improve the long-term future. We should improve things like the scientific process or political institutions or not try and create war with great powers. This is a non-answer. You don't have to adopt long-termism to think these are important problems. This is what we're trying to do all the time. Collectively, we're always trying to improve political institutions. We're always trying to improve the scientific process. We're trying to speed up the rate at which we solve problems. This doesn't require adopting long-termism as a framework.
Can I pause you? I missed what the move was. Can you say that again? Can you set up the situation and then what the move is? I know you said it, I just missed it. And so,
yeah, so I see. Yeah. So there's this. So in general, right, there's like the philosophical claim that what matters most is future generations. But then you can start drilling people on like, okay, what does it mean to care about that, right? So what sort of action should we take? And this is where the paper spends like, you know, 5 or 6 pages sort of cataloging this. The most prominent reason is like, well, we should work to reduce the threat of advanced artificial intelligence because this could plausibly take over the world. We've spent like, you know, an episode or two talking about that, so I don't want to dive into that. But a lot of the other suggestions are sort of like, you know, improve political institutions, improve our ability to make better decisions, try and speed up progress so that any of the benefits we would have accrued, for example, in 2030 actually happen in 2029, so that we can improve cumulative growth like that. And to adopt those sort of solutions or to think those sorts of problems are worth solving doesn't require adopting long-termism as a framework.
Exactly.
So, you know, the thing I want to emphasize is like, you actually, like by right now, as EA currently stands and like the problems it prioritizes, they don't actually require long-termism as a framework. It's like, we're in this weird uncanny valley with this problem where like the actual like things that people are proposing to work on mostly don't require long-termism, except possibly AI safety. But again, we should borrow that for another time. But the rest of it are actually very real concerns. Like you don't have to buy that we should only care about people 1 million years in the future to worry about nuclear threat, to worry about climate change. Like you don't have to buy these. And so what I'm really criticizing here is the possibility of people developing new ideas based on this philosophy that throw out any of these future concern or current concerns, in lieu of like stuff farther down the road. So we're at this like bizarre place where this philosophy is really weird, but the actual practical implications of it so far aren't insanely out to lunch.
So that is exactly, okay. So that is a really important point to, I think, triple emphasize. So the, right now, the philosophy, is making all these arguments that what we should care about are people in literally a billion years from now. That's not a straw man. A billion years from now. And then from this, they come up with the number 10 to the 15, which again, they just came up with big numbers. But the conclusions that I draw from this is, you may want to, reallocate some of your, like, charitable portfolio, charitable givings portfolio to some causes which are slightly more long-term focused. I can get there without doing any of that Bayesian expected value calculus just by saying it makes sense to distribute your portfolio slightly so that you care about the future as well. Like the future, you're going to be there. And so you want to have a wide portfolio. You don't need to do all this nonsense. But what you do need to do this nonsense for is these apocalyptic AI doomsday scenarios. And so I don't think we can actually divorce this subject as much, because the only causes which actually require this nonsense are those which don't have good explanations that could be used instead. So I want to emphasize two points. One is that the explanation is primary perspective, is a unifier of morality and science and progress in general, because explanations apply just as much to morality and moral claims as they do to scientific claims. So it is a unified view. And the second point is that when good explanations aren't available, you basically have two options. You can pivot your focus because something's wrong, or you can start generating terrible ones, terrible explanations, because your focus, you're not going to pivot that at all. And what this produces are arguments like long-termism, which aren't needed in, say, defending climate change research, defending anti-nuclear terrorism, defending all sorts of these ideas, which we can come up with good explanations for that instantaneously. We don't need any of this nonsense. But we do need it for these scenarios which they draw out in the piece. And so that should put people on high alert, I think, that when people have to default to the long-termism claim, it's because they don't have a better one that they could use. They shouldn't need this for issues which are pressing and immediate, or within a generation or two. So it should put people on guard, because it is the default move. It's the one that you can always turn to when all other explanations fail. You can pull this out of your pocket and talk about expected values till the fucking cows come home, because you can always do this. It doesn't have any requirements to be constrained by what we know about global poverty, what we know about geopolitics and the likelihood of governments forming a world,
tyrannical world government. But
yeah, like, so where we have real knowledge, where we have actual information, you tend to get much better arguments coming out. And so I just want to caution people who are hearing all this stuff for the first time, that it should be seen as a signal that there's not something better underneath.
Yeah, that's a really good point, I think, because the explanation is the unifier of all this stuff, right? Like, it doesn't just apply in science, it applies in morality as well. Why we should care impartially about people in different countries is a good moral explanation, and that's why we take it seriously. It's not because we have some credence in it. It's not because we justify it with numbers. It's because we have a good explanation as to why that's the case.
Exactly. And we seek good explanations too. And we should continuously seek them from other people. But yeah, so like, where are we? We introduced the main thesis. We haven't really explained how they argue for it. And the paper kind of introduces the claim. Then it talks about what would change if people endorse the claim, focusing mainly on charitable giving. But then they do say that they expect it to influence like all sorts of decision making, not just charitable giving, which is where, again, it gets quite frightening.
Yeah, they say, quote, "We believe that axiological and deontic strong long-termism," which we're not going to, I don't think we're going to differentiate between those. I don't think it's worth it, "are of the utmost importance. If society came to adopt these views, much of what we would prioritize in the world today would change." And so any idea that purports to like change our value system quite radically, deserves to just like be scrutinized. So,
yeah.
And I feel like in the EA community right now, there's just not enough criticism being generated of the idea, or at least the criticism is only of a particular sort where people argue about the precise probabilities you can place on certain estimates or something. I don't think there's much coming externally to that framework.
Yeah. So I think you have a much better sense of the kinds of conversations that are happening within the community. And I would just love to go into that as if we can, what kinds of arguments are being generated? Because it's just so apparent to me that this is a recipe for disaster, and it's not there yet, of course not, but telling people they don't have to really care about how they treat this generation, the next generation, or generations about 1,000 years from now, doesn't really matter, is like, it's not strong long-termism, it's like sociopathic long-termism. It's very, very dangerous.
So, I mean, yeah, so the consequences certainly aren't spelled out like that. The framing is much different. So the framing is something like, there's extraordinary suffering in the world today. And we could work to try and alleviate this. There's the suffering of animals, there's suffering of humans, and there are a variety of means we could use to try and alleviate the suffering. But there's this other group of people who is completely ignored in most moral frameworks and in any political discussions. And those are people who will live in the far future. And this group of people, from, a social justice standpoint even, is completely neglected, right? So if we think there are some groups of disenfranchised people today, the people of the future have absolutely no say in how they will be treated by us, right? They aren't represented in our political processes, and they aren't taken into account in most moral frameworks. And so the position really is one of compassion, I think, by most people in the community, right? So it's not that they want to ignore the suffering in the present, right? Even though that happens to be a consequence of the view. It's that they're looking at the suffering and they're cringing and they're thinking, should I do something about this? And then they're weighing it against this other group of people, which they see as more vulnerable, right? So they see a larger group of people as more vulnerable.
Yeah.
And so they're saying, I know it feels wrong to ignore the people who I could be distributing bed nets to, but there's this argument that tells me that there's going to be even more people I could help in the future.
This is all such ideologies. And I say the word ideology not as a term of disparagement, but as a way to classify this idea amongst similar other ideas. Mm. So ideologies tend to evolve certain defense mechanisms to make them impervious to criticism. And all of them tend to have compassion at the root. The compassion for the working class, compassion for the poor Aryans who are being overtaken by the Jews, compassion for the Muslim populations who are being constantly bombed by the United States. Compassion is always there, or at least there in heavy helpings. This is why Paul Bloom was so excellent when he talked about the problems with empathy, right?
Yeah.
Because it can be so easily turned in slightly the wrong direction, and people will run off cliffs thinking they're making the world better. This is always going to be with us. And at least with this long-termism thing, it feels like, if I had the opportunity of waving my wand, getting rid of postmodernism after the first publication and just preventing this whole disaster of a philosophy, I would have loved to do that. But I anticipate long-termism as being close to that. And so I feel like it is just on the cusp of doing the same to charitable giving as what postmodernism did to philosophy and all of the humanities and stuff in general. So anyway, the fact that compassion is at the root of it makes perfect sense. Mm-hmm. Of course it is. Maybe the thing that differentiates it is often it's compassion for people who are alive right now, and then you're promised a utopia in the future. But in this one, it's compassion for people who don't exist, and it's compassion for people who are 5 billion years ahead of us. And so it's still channeling the compassion sensors in our brain. It's just a different flavor of it.
Yeah, exactly. And some pieces try and make it more real. They try and hijack this empathy module that we have. So Nick Bostrom wrote this essay called Letters from Utopia, where we're being written to from people in the future who write please don't mess things up, because we have reached a state of utopia in the future and things are perfect and we experience constant bliss all the time. But for us to actually reach this state, you are required to make the right choices in the present today. And so it's this heavy moral weight, I think, that people feel in the community, where it is hard, of course, not to help those of today, but they do feel like they're, you know, you're by lowering extinction risk by 0.001%, wherever that number comes from, you are helping many more people than you would if you were to donate to the Against Malaria Foundation or something. So yeah, definitely coming from a good place, which makes the idea even harder to criticize, I think, right? Because there's no evil scapegoat that you can point to that's like obviously steering people wrong. There's just bad ideas that very good people have started to adopt that can steer them in wrong directions. And I guess, yeah, this is most ideologies. No one is the myth of pure evil to think that there's just some person at the top who's like controlling everything just in order to laugh at everyone. Everyone always thinks they're in the right when they adopt extreme positions. Okay, so there's two premises that I think that get the thesis off the ground. I think what they would claim would be like necessary and sufficient conditions. The first one is that, quote, in expectation, the future is vast in size. Vast meaning the number of humans or sentient beings to come after it. The second being that all consequences matter equally, and with equality here referring to over time. So temporally, all consequences matter equally. So whether if Alice suffers by 0.5 amounts in right now, and Bob is suffering 0.5 amounts in 150 years, those are indistinguishable from an ethical standpoint. And so we should be equally concerned with both of them. So I think you have done the most thinking about the actual mathematical aspects of the claim in expectation of the future is vast in size. So you want to?
So what I should say is this is what the majority of the little forthcoming piece is going to be on. And so anything that I say here should basically be heard after you read that piece, because it's going to be hard to keep in mind without having some visual aids. So I think that in expectation, the future is undefined. So that's basically the main thrust of my argument for that part. For the second claim, which says that we shouldn't prefer things to happen sooner, I think that's also totally wrong. So I'll deal with that one in a second. But in expectation, the future is undefined. What do I mean by that? So what I mean is when you go to do an expected value calculation, what you're doing is you're multiplying a probability by a utility. And then the utility is conditioned on the action. And the probability is conditioned on the action as well. The thing, though, is that in this paper and in, I think, all of the work, they don't just like actually write out all the symbols so you can see all of the various interlocking pieces. When you compute probabilities, you compute a probability over a set of things. So let's talk about infinite sets for a second. We're getting super technical because we have to go down into the details to argue against this stuff.
Well, actually, yeah, before you go down into the details, I want to inoculate us against a form of criticism here, which is that I could see someone saying, okay, but, you know, you're taking this too technically. You're taking this too literally. Like, we're just talking about what will probably happen. No, you are not allowed to make that move. So you cannot start talking about expectations and expected futures and expected futures number of people if you're not ready to rigorously define it. There's, you know, if you're going to start using terms like expectation, actually reasoning based on expected value calculus, you have to go down the rabbit hole of like, what are you measuring? What's your probability measure? Is the set of futures countable? Like all these questions, they've really become important because you're using those tools. You started this debate, right? So I just want to make sure that there's no room to stand where you're saying they're getting too technical. You cannot. That's an illegitimate.
I like that. Yeah. Another way to say that is we didn't bring the math into the conversation. Exactly. Like again, we like math. Math is great. We just know it's a tool that can be used sometimes. But anyways, so we have to get technical because that's what they are asking us. So I'm going to use the measure theoretic view of probability because that is the one that all mathematicians use. And let me just say for a second that, like, what do you think mathematicians are doing all day? They're figuring out when you can and cannot apply probabilities. Like, it is not just this arbitrary thing you can fucking throw everywhere you like. There is very careful conditions for when you can apply probability and when you can't. And the whole reason we have measure theory, the reason we talk about sigma algebras and stuff, is because you can't just apply probability all willy-nilly to infinite sets. If you try to do that, everything will break. And that's why we have sigma algebras, and that's why we have all of this stuff.
That's why math is fucking hard.
That's why math is hard. Yeah. And if you don't know what I'm talking about when I say the word sigma algebra, then you shouldn't be talking about expected
values. Yeah, exactly.
Okay. Yeah. So let's just consider an infinite set for us.
We're going to have to put a fucking chapter marker in here so that people who don't want to deal with this can skip ahead.
Again, we didn't bring expected values into the conversation.
Yeah.
They did. So I'm just describing how it works. Okay, so if you want to apply the very notion of probability to a set of things, the set of things that you apply it to has to abide by certain conditions. Okay, what does that mean? The technical jargon term would be that it's a measurable set, but that doesn't, if I say that, that would be an appeal to authority because I'm just using a word which I know people don't understand. So I'm not going to say that it's just a measurable set and then pretend like that answers the question because it doesn't. Let's talk about a set that's not measurable, for example, that will make the point stick. So I want the listener to imagine an alternating sequence of red and black balls. This goes red, black, red, black, red, black, red, black. And then I ask, okay, what's the probability of drawing a red ball? I think the obvious thing that you would say is it's 50% because they're alternating, like red, black, red, black. Turns out that's not true. That's wrong. And it's wrong because it's an infinite sequence. So what you can do is you can take all the black balls, like let's say take 5 black balls from the future. Notice I'm using the word future because you can draw from it an infinite amount. Take the 5 red balls, put them next to a black ball. Take another 5 red balls, put them next to a black ball. 5 more, put them next to a black ball. And now what originally looked like an alternating sequence of red, black, is red, black, 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 red, black, 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 black. Or I might have got the colors backwards, but whatever. So now what originally looked like a 50% probability is a 1 in 6, if it's little chunks of 6 sequences. So the point of this, though, is that if a set isn't measurable, what that means is you can pretty much define probability however the fuck you want by rearranging stuff inside the set arbitrarily. Okay, so I know we're getting technical, but I'm just going to stay right here and keep it technical. So the main point, though, is if you have an infinite set of stuff, let's just say 2 kinds of stuff, it doesn't make sense at all to talk about relative frequencies because you can make the relative frequency anything you like. You can just move a bunch of white balls next to a black ball, etc. This is why you can't, for example, talk about what the probability of an even number is in the natural numbers. But that doesn't make any sense. Because you can rearrange the natural numbers however you like. And so arbitrariness is the thing which mathematicians are very scrupulous to avoid. The whole point of math is to say that when you can just make arbitrary changes, this is no longer a mathematical concept. We have to pin it down more precisely. And this is like why measure theory and sigma algebras were invented in the first place. They're invented because there's something called the Banach-Tarski paradox. I've never actually said that out loud.
Yeah.
Which basically says that you can take a set. I think it's a Euclidean set of like 4, 3 and greater dimensions. I might be wrong about that. And if you have a sphere in that set, you can rearrange the pieces to get 2 spheres. And so if you just allow arbitrariness into your system, then you can produce absurdities. And I think this is called the law of contradiction, or there's a word for this, that as soon as you allow one contradiction or one absurdity into your framework, then you can derive any absurdity you like whatsoever.
Yeah.
Okay. So what have we learned? We've learned that we can't be all willy-nilly when we apply probability to sets. That's the main thing. There's rules here. We have to be careful. Okay, let's consider now the set of all possible futures, which is what these expectations are over. And if they're not over that, then I don't know what people mean when they say expectation. I've actually asked, I confirmed this with you. You're like, yeah, I think that's right. But even if you're not sure, then that is itself indication that people aren't talking seriously when they use this word. They just are using it.
Yeah. I mean, they say, in expectation, the future is vast in size. If your expectation is not referring to the future, then yeah. I don't know.
So presumably you're averaging over a bunch of different future possibilities. There may be a move of going to the multiverse here. I know that Hilary Greaves, for example, has done a lot of work on multiverse interpretations of probability. That's fine. It doesn't apply to the future because of the argument from epistemology that you can't predict the future when the future depends on the contents of future knowledge, which we don't have by definition. So the term there is reach. The word is reach if you want to go into David Deutsch's book. But even in the multiverse interpretation of quantum mechanics, there are limitations on what you can predict. That's my main point. And so the recourse to, well, the multiverse will get us out of this problem is it's a non-starter. So don't try it. But anyway, so now let's consider the set of all futures. Is this measurable? Obviously fucking not. We don't even know what is in it. We don't know what it looks like. We don't know what imagine considering the set of all futures in the 1900s. What would you put in there? Would you put the internet in there? Would you put birth control in there?
QAnon?
Modified? QAnon. Of course, it's impossible. You don't know it. You cannot put the future in there. Just stand, not like, you don't even go like 1 billion quadrillion years into the future. Just go like 10 years back in the past and see if you could predict the stuff that's in the right now. Of course not. We don't know. We can't know. It's an impossible. It's an impermeable wall of mystery. So the bottom line is that people are being so sloppy with their definitions here. And if you're going to use math, that's great. Like in the little piece, I made a figure and it's obviously sarcastic, but it, I think, actually represents the arguments of long-termism. And like the listener should imagine a scatter plot and you draw a trend line and on the x-axis, it's time between 0 and 1 billion. And on the y-axis, it is cumulative expected value. And then you just draw a trend line. And then you can just arbitrarily say the cumulative expected value of action A is taller, larger, the arrow is higher than action B. Except this scatter plot doesn't have any data on it. It's just lines. You've just drawn lines on a fucking wall. And you don't realize that when people actually use them to really solve problems, they are so scrupulous. They never just throw the word expectation in front of stuff and call it a day. They are very careful to be sure that it applies in this circumstance. This is as ridiculous as talking about the set of all dreams or the set of all ghosts or the set of all sneezes, the set of, like, you can just say this. You can say this word. I'm going to talk about the set of all dreams, and then I can talk about the expected dream that we have, where I'm going to take the probability of each possible dream that Ben has and I have, and I'm going to multiply that probability of that dream with the amount of, I don't know, sex that I have in that dream. And the expected amount of sex that I have is infinite. High. Like, this is infinite. Yeah. Like, this is just playing word games. Like, we're not being at all careful with how these concepts are used. And so the only sensible thing that somebody can say about the expected value of the future is that it's undefined. It doesn't make any sense. It is a poorly defined concept, and therefore it shouldn't be used to make serious moral decisions at all. And we should just laugh at it because it is ridiculous and it deserves to just be seen as a good attempt and a mistake, and we need to try something else. And that's all.
Oh God, that was good, man. That was really good. That was an epic monologue. I gotta say, you have a very nice ability to explain complex mathematical concepts. I had never heard someone explain certain paradoxes the way you do, but I just want to emphasize that this is very standard math. Like, if you ever sat in like a intro to set theory class and gone over the argument that the set of even numbers is the same, has the same cardinality as the set of all whole numbers or the set of all integers, it's the same math at work, right? This is not controversial math. This is not super advanced stuff. This is like very basic, just like counting, you know, what sizes have difficulties when you start dealing with infinities.
The whole reason that this mathematical edifice and that there's so much work to be done is because mathematicians are avoiding paradoxes. Mm-hmm. The whole point of this is that they recognize that if they introduce one false assumption, that if they slip up even once, then everything they've built is just nonsense. If you introduce a paradox, you can just produce nonsense all day long, every day. And that's why there is a discipline of mathematics. It's very careful. It's very scrupulous. And you don't just say things like this. And I haven't heard any good justification for this stuff. It's just this spiral down into this well of publications from which no one emerges. And you just get sucked into this vortex of terminology and labels, and you lose all bearing on what the fuck is going on.
But yeah, if a listener has a reference for like where this is precisely defined, I would like to read it. I have not read Nick Beckstead's entire thesis, so possibly it's hidden in there. But
that's a fantastic point. Here's my falsifiable claim that it is a citation vortex, and that everyone's citing everyone, and there is actually no definition at the bottom of it.
There's no ground truth.
Let's just be clear here. If there is a concept that allows us to see 1 billion years into the future, then this would be revolutionary. This would change everything that we know about physics and science and epistemology, and it would be as revolutionary a claim as traveling faster than the speed of light. This is a hugely revolutionary claim. It's like when people just cavalierly talk about homeopathy, and they say, well, yeah, it could probably work. And it's like, if it was true that the more you dilute something, the more powerful it got, then everything we know about modern physics and chemistry would be completely wrong. And that would be groundbreaking. Analogously, if it's true that we can see 1 billion years into the future using expected value calculus, then that would change everything we think about time and space, and it would be revolutionary. I am decently willing to bet that it's just a mistake.
But what's your credence? That's all.
Damn it. That's a really good point. Yeah, in the expectation, probably not a mistake.
But think of the consequences if it was true. So in expectation, it must be. Yeah.
Okay, so that's one of the two claims, but we got to do the second one.
Yeah, okay. So the second claim is all consequences matter equally. So what I understand them saying here is, can be sort of summarized as follows. Like, picture the universe as a block universe where you have like the three dimensions of space. And then imagine these three dimensions expanded over time. So you're sort of like, you have this three-dimensional axis, and then you drag this out over time. And so you're given this substance that you can like point at any one of these times, and like reduce all the suffering, or maybe increase the well-being of everything, or of every sentient being like existing at that point in time. And so I understand sort of the intuition that this paper is playing with of like, where should you point, where should you distribute that substance, right? And so in the future, by this sort of expected value calculus, there's going to be way more people. And so you should hold on to this substance. You shouldn't distribute it now, even though you could cure ills now, you can increase well-being now, but you're going to help more people if you do it in the future. And so it may seem callous, but this is a simple utility maximization problem, right? We have limited resources, we have this substance, and we need to figure out how to best distribute it over time. And so we need to, there's going to be more people in the time. We don't know exactly when we should distribute the substance, but we kind of know it shouldn't be now. So we should wait. And then we'll leave the vagueness of when we should distribute it later. Or maybe in the meantime, we try and figure out how to create more of the substance or something like that. This is a terrible way to think about consequences. Okay, so I'm going to reiterate that there's a place to stand here where you do care about future well-being, but the question is, how do we actually affect future well-being? And the answer is not to wait and just withhold all our action, thinking we know everything we need to know right now, and then trying to make the world a better place later. The answer is trying to solve the problems that exist right now, because those are the pressing problems and the only ones we actually have a hope of solving, because they're the only problems that we know exist. We don't even know what the problems will be in the future. And so the way we've made progress so far, and the only way we know how to reliably generate knowledge, is to solve the problems right now, with coming up with like the best theories, the best explanations we can. We apply those right now, those generate new problems, and then we tackle those in turn. And incrementally, we figure out more and more about the world, we improve our moral systems, we improve our science, we improve our technology, and we just increase the well-being of everyone at every time. It's sort of the difference between like a passive and active role that people have in morality, right? So I get the sense that this paper sort of takes a, it's like it takes a passive view. It's like, we're just, you know, we're witnessing history. We have the ability to distribute some well-being at any point in time. And we have to figure out when is the best time to distribute this well-being. But that's not the question. The question is, how do we reliably keep making progress? And the way we keep making progress is to keep solving the problems that we're presented with, because those are the only problems we can even have a hope of solving, right? So we need to keep alive a quote unquote tradition of criticism, if you want to use Popper's language, or we need to keep the method of error correction alive, if you want to use Deutschian language, whoever language you want to use. The point is that there's problems right now. Those are the only problems we can solve, and solving those problems generates all kinds of knowledge, moral knowledge, technological knowledge, scientific knowledge, artistic knowledge, and to sort of reliably make the future better, the only thing we can do right now is act on the problems we know right now.
The big glaring thing that I think this is missing, that they really have not addressed at all, is that the future and the present are completely different. The future never arrives, but we're always in the present. So we're always moving in the present, but there will always be a 1,000-year future horizon in front of us. Why is this important? It's because they're saying you can completely and utterly disregard how you treat people for the next 1,000 years. There will always be the next 1,000 years. At any point in time, there will be the next 1,000 years. And so this is a straightforward justification to treat people cruelly forever, because the present always moves forward. We always have the next 1,000 years, and they're telling people that you don't have to care at all about the consequences of your actions in the next 1,000 years. And so this is just encouraging cruelty forever. And this is why we absolutely should have a preference for the present, because the present is all we always in the present. We only ever have now. And now is the only opportunity we have to make the world better. And this is exactly your point, which is that we know how to make the world better. And that is by solving problems and gaining knowledge and working towards a better future. Excellent. The assumption that is underlying this claim that we shouldn't prefer good things to occur now is that we're just like these beggars with our arms outstretched, waiting for good things to be like poured into our bowl. We're just like mendicants, just waiting for the manna to be just distributed to us, rather than being active participants, rather than being those who bring about the good things. Like, we are the ones who can produce the good things. And the good things come only through human effort and human attempts to improve the world. And if you tell people that you shouldn't prefer now than later, then how defeatist is this? How much does this just strip people of the desire to try to fix anything? And so the very act of telling people this is the thing which is going to prevent the good things from coming in the first place. So of course we should prefer the present, because we are only ever in the present. And just try patiently to convince people to work on eliminating present day suffering. And if every generation does this, then this will be a great world, where every generation tries to make the world a little bit better for the next generation. This is the most moral and humanistic philosophy I could possibly espouse. And long-termism is the negation of all of that.
Fascinatingly, so Toby Ord in The Precipice, which is arguing for this like long-termist philosophy, you know, he makes the argument that we've been handed down progress and values from like past generations, and it's our job to improve on this and continue this tradition onwards. But ironically, it's only because these past generations were focused on solving the problems of their time, because they knew nothing of our problems, that we are where we are. And so, in fact, if we were to only try and focus on problems of which we know nothing about, this would be breaking the tradition, right? All one generation can do is solve its problems so that it can hand the next generation an incrementally better world, a world that's marginally improved, that has slightly less drastic, slightly more interesting problems for them to solve, instead of putting a stop to this tradition of progress and instead asking only, what can we do to influence the very far off? So, you know, like, I it's not that I discount well-being in the future. That has nothing to do with it. It's just that I recognize that the way to actually improve lives, both now and possible lives later, is to solve the problems that we can now in order to continue this tradition of incrementally improving everything in each generation, our values, our science, our technology, our art. And so it's just a plea for like how to actually make progress. It has nothing to do with saying fuck you to the next generations. In fact, it's quite the opposite. I think only focusing on future generation problems would be more of a fuck you to them, because it's saying we did not solve any problems on our own. We were just guessing at what your problems were and trying to solve them as if we knew what they're going to be better than you did.
It is such an important point. Yeah. Like there is absolutely no way that someone in Jesus Christ's time would have the ability to solve problems in nuclear physics. And yet we are being told that there is the ability to solve problems a billion years from now.
And then, yeah, so just 2 points worth reiterating, I think. One is that you don't have to throw out the worry about like existential risks from threats that we're actually well informed about.
Yeah.
That it continues to be a problem, of course. And it continues to be a problem because it is a problem right now.
Yes, exactly.
It's not more complicated than that. It's a problem right now. And of course, we need to work to solve that problem. So we need to continue nuclear disarmament, for example. And we need to work on containing viruses better in laboratories. Of course, we don't want those spilling out. Like, those are real problems to solve right now. You don't need to adopt long-termism for this. And the second point I wanted to make is just, if your answer to, well, if you're in 200 AD, of course, you know, predicting what kind of problems you'd have in the year 2020 is impossible. You can't predict specific problems, but you could work on general things like trying to promote science or reduce religious dogmatism or promote human rights. Those are incrementalist responses. So again, you don't need to adopt long-termism to think those are good things to push for. Those are still the problems we're trying to solve, right? Again, we're trying to promote human values. We're trying to increase the reach of science. We're trying to improve our moral theories. Like, those again do not need this belief that the most of our moral weight lies in 2 billion years hence. Like, only have to throw it, like, as this philosophy is operationalized right now, you don't need to throw it that much, unless it has a really bad explanation, like you were saying, unless it's just the doomsday scenario of AI takeover. That's like the only thing you have to get rid of right now. And so it shouldn't actually contradict most of your cherished beliefs, but I'm worried about, you know, where this can go in the future, if this advice is like truly taken on board. Yeah,
it's like you know how like Unreal Tournament will sometimes replace its like engine, and so the game kind of stays the same, but the whole core underneath it gets upgraded. If you get rid of Bayesian epistemology and you put in Popperian epistemology, you get to keep all of the things
so
you care about.
Exactly.
It's just way more powerful because the underlying philosophical core is much more robust, explains much more, and it preserves everything you care about. Everything that you like, you want to make the world better, you want to donate your time and money into improving the world, it's all there. It's all there. You just swap out this outdated philosophy and you put in a more robust one. It is such a refreshing perspective, because all this confusion that used to be like associated with thinking about morality and thinking about science and thinking about all sorts of subjects just falls away. And that isn't to say that you just have this perfect problem-free universe. It's just that you recognize problems and you see them and then you work on them.
Yeah.
And then it's fun. You just see, like, this is, I see this current conversation, long-termism, I see this as a problem and like, I just want to work on it. It's so liberating. And it just enables progress and happiness, because epistemology and morality and subjective sense of well-being all are unified, because it's fun to work to improve the world and make it a better place through knowledge. And that's great. And I guess that's why we're both so excited about it too, right? Like, to be optimistic, like it is, like the world is a great fucking place. And like, we have made so much progress and we're going to continue to make progress. And it's through conversations like this and through amazing organizations like GiveWell and Effective Altruist, and William McCaskill himself is like a leader in this field, and he should rightly be celebrated. And he has an amazing legacy, and I really hope he preserves it. And they just need to replace this old outdated module with a much more refined one. And I think all of the things that they're working towards will be better.
Well, you can even keep your entire Twitter handle. You just have to remove promoter of long-termism. You know, that's just, you're so close, man.
Yeah,
you just gotta about delete that.
So I don't know what we're gonna talk about next, because I feel like we covered a hell of a lot of territory, but hopefully it'll piss a good amount of people off, because that means that the criticism is working.
And, yeah. If nothing, it'll generate traffic.